Jetzt Aktien kaufen. Was tun bei Inflation und steigenden Zinsen? Wie tickt die Wirtschaft?
Hallo und herzlich willkommen bei Focus Money Talks, dem Podcast mit Heike Banger zu allen Themen rund um euer Geld.
Hello and welcome to Focus Money Talks. I'm Heike Banger and I'd like to extend a warm welcome to you today and apologize in advance for the fact that the whole episode is in English. This is due to my guest today, who I'm very pleased to have with me. How to become a billionaire? I asked the man who is considered one of the superlatives in more ways than one. Ken Fisher is a multiple billionaire, best-selling author, the columnist who wrote the portfolio strategy column in Forbes in more than 32 years. I am delighted that he is continuing this tradition at Focus Money. And of course, he manages one of the world's largest investment portfolios. So, let's talk about how he does it, how he got started, and why, at almost 75 years, he's not thinking about retiring. It's a great pleasure, and I feel honored to speak today with an investor who is considered the most successful, one of the most successful in the world. Welcome, Ken Fisher, to Focus Money Talks.
Thank you for having me. It is an honor to have you interview me. It's always an honor to be associated with Focus Money in any regard.
Thank you so much for your time. It's a bit more common in Germany not to talk about money. Different is it in the US, where income and wealth are seen as a sign of success and a blueprint for future success. Today we want to talk primarily about the opportunities and risks on the current capital markets, but also a little bit about you. So let me go at in like a bull at a gate. How did you get a billionaire, and what advice would you give to our listeners and readers who want to reach the same?
So becoming a billionaire is obviously not a common thing. And the main way that it happens, other than being born to billionaire parents somehow, which no one can actually plan for, is to create some form of business that becomes very valuable. In my case, that was doubly so because in starting my firm, it reinvests back into capital markets. So it gets the growth of the firm plus the growth of the capital markets, and it's a kind of twofer, a doubling. And so in that regard, my wealth has grown at a very high rate for a very long time, because I'm actually going to be 74 years old in November, and I've been doing this for over half a century, and it compounds over time. It just compounds at a higher rate than most people compound at.
But as far as you said, a long time horizon, investors have to take into account.
Instead of becoming a billionaire, almost anyone can become a millionaire just by saving, and Germans are very frugal, and then investing in reasonably long-term predictable ways that generate fairly high long-term returns. And if you compound at some good number for a long period of time off of savings, and you keep saving, you know, anyone can become worth $5, $10 million. It's not that hard to do if you play the math of it. Not quite becoming a billionaire, but anyone can become what most people think of as a wealthy person by saving from the time they're young and then investing in relatively high return assets like the stock market over the long term, which has a high long-term return, which a lot of people get scared away from by the volatility that comes along the route to that.
So let's see this goal, getting a millionaire. According to the recently published Global Wealth Report by Allianz, Germans perform poorly internationally in terms of per capita wealth. In contrast to the Americans have more than three times as much in their investment portfolios than Germans have. What can Germans learn from the Americans?
Well, we can say this several different ways, and Germans may take some offense at what I say. But there's two features. I mean, Germans are frugal. Germans save. That's all good. That works. But Americans have traditionally been, near by global standards, crazy innovators. And most of, for example, in the public stock market, the large, very large market capitalization, total market value companies of the last 100 years, 50 years, have been created by crazy Americans who had some crazy idea for something that no one had ever done yet, that in some part of the world changed the world. A lot of that in recent years has been technology, but it's, you know, gone back in time for a long time in many categories. Not all of it everywhere, but if you look at the companies with over $100 billion market value, most all of the new ones have come out of the United States, and that's because of those crazy Americans coming up with crazy ideas. And Germans have not been prone to be as innovative in those ways. That's the one part. And then the other part is inherently, and I don't mean this in a critical way, but I've measured this, Germans in what finance calls loss aversion, which is how much do you hate a loss compared to loving a gain, Germans are just more loss averse than Americans. Every time you take a risk, you are, of course, running a potential risk that you lose money. But risk and return at one level go together.
Absolutely. That would have been my question. On the stock markets, the optimists meet the pessimists. As you already said, the question is, what is actually more worthwhile at the end, being optimistic or being pessimistic? So you said the much better way is to be optimistic, isn't it?
Yes, and let me say that this way. The greatest wealth is created by the creation of entities that do never yet done practices, that change some part of the world. And with that comes this other feature that most people don't think about. Some person starts a company that, like Amazon, becomes huge and changes a part of the world the way it did parts of retailing. And with that, its employees and its vendors and even people that learn to, in other businesses, imitate it in competition, all get wealthier. So if you look at the number of people that are not billionaires, but are millionaires created out of being employees in a place like Amazon, it's huge compared to the number of people that would reach similar financial status working in an older company that didn't have the increase in value over time the way that new innovative company does. Ways that never yet done practices that change the world and create the value.
So it seems that the biggest mistakes for investors is not to invest than to make a mistake once?
Yeah, let me say that this way in a different way. And I've written about this in my Focus Money column. A 1% down move is not identical, but is similarly volatile in terms of volatility, one measure of risk, to a 1% up move. A 1% down move is similarly volatile to a 1% up move, but people don't think of the 1% up as volatile. They only think of the down as volatile. Mm-hmm. And they don't like the down. They like the up. But the average American hates the down about 2.5 times as much as they love the up, whereas the average German hates the down about 6 times as much as they love the up. That's the biggest difference in the Germans not being as eager to take risks in new, different things that might not succeed, might fail. And of course, many Americans fail at starting businesses. But the businesses that are started like that, that do succeed, pull along a lot of people with it who get the wealth to build those portfolios that you talked about that makes a difference between how much the average American has invested versus how much the average German has invested.
But nevertheless, all the Germans are allowed to invest in the crazy, successful American companies, aren't they?
Which I'm sure can be annoying to a lot of people to be investing in companies outside of their country. It was not very long ago in time, just a quarter century ago, that few people invested outside of their own country. You know, Germans in those days might have had some commonality to things in Austria or to some commonality in things in Switzerland, but to invest in things on the other side of the world 25 years ago would have seemed strange to most Americans and most Germans and most Japanese and most people everywhere. Now, because of the advances in technology and the ability to understand what's going on around the world, it's more common. And one of the advantages that I had in life is that I started off doing that a long, long time ago. And I started off being fully global in the 1990s.
So let's talk a bit about the current situation. So how important is it for investors to take a look at the current situation?
Well, there's, again, as in my mind, so many things, there's two parts to the answer. One part is you should always be focused on the long term, because that's where you're going to, unless you're very, very old. I mean, we all, unless we're very, very old, have a long term. And most of us have a longer long term than we think we have, because today people live much longer than they used to, and actually longer than most actuarial tables assume we will live. So if you're the average 55-year-old, you may think you're looking to retire in 10 years and you should be conservative. But in reality, you're probably going to need your money statistically for at least another 30 years. And that's a long time. The other part that goes with that, however, is you have to make a decision. And focused money readers are prone to making these kinds of decisions. Do you invest in these things or do you invest in those things? And that's not passive, that's active. And if you're investing in that kind of decision, you have to think about always, and this is central to the way markets work, what's the difference between current expectations, which fits into your comment about the now, and actual realities? The difference between expectations and subsequent perception of realities will determine what direction prices go. So this applies both to the time where you decide to be defensive against markets as a whole, when to be offensive against markets as a whole, as well as what categories of things do you underweight versus overweight. And by that, I have, for most of my career, since I was very young, believed in the notion of actively managing against a stated benchmark that's made up of a definable universe of things, and based on my perception of expectations versus reality, what are the current expectations that people believe will happen versus what can you say probably will really happen? Where do I underweight things relative to that index, which is a benchmark to manage against, and where do I overweight? And so you're talking about, yes, paying attention to the current, but remembering that the current, and particularly current expectations, are very often very wrong.
The current situation is affected by the Federal Reserve. So 2 weeks ago, the Federal Reserve has markets surprised with an unusually large interest rate move. Have you been surprised too? And does it make any difference to what you are thinking now on the capital markets?
People who've read me for a long time will not be surprised by my answer. People who have not may just think I'm crazy. In fact, a lot of people think I'm crazy, and that's good by me. The fact is, I don't believe that the central banks, whether it's the Federal Reserve, or the ECB, or the Bank of Japan, or the Bank of England, actually control very much that really matters about where the economy goes or where the stock market goes, or for that matter, where long-term interest rates go. Even though they think they do, and most people think they do. Central to investing is knowing the difference between what everybody thinks and what's real. And the fact is, most people believe, and I understand why, that when the central bank does this or that to interest rates, that's going to be very important, even prescriptive, if you will, to the economy and to the stock market. Statistics will tell you, if you actually analyze that very carefully, that they aren't. But if they were, for example, the many increases in short-term interest rates that both the Federal Reserve and the ECB did off the bottom of the stock market in 2022 would have both rendered a recession and killed bull market, which they didn't do. And in fact, if you look at the German market, it was hitting all-time highs before the ECB made its first interest rate cut this year. Ditto, of course, for the S&P 500. If interest rates were prescriptive and controlling, and the central bank could control that, none of that would occur. When I was very young, I studied economics a lot and came to believe that the discipline of economics is faulty in that it's not quite the way things really work. But I've also believed, and I could talk about this for a long time, that central bankers and central banks are largely misguided in what they think works, in the way they think. I've written about this a lot, and I've written about this in Focus Money, that in fact, they don't know what they're going to do ever. So when you say surprised in your question that the U.S. Federal Reserve in September cut overnight bank lending reserves by 0.5% or 1%, I'm not ever really surprised by what they do because I don't pay too much attention, and I kind of think they're crazy to begin with. People are going to think that I'm crazy because I think what they do doesn't matter very much. But A, I think that people to think what they do that matters, they think that I think those people are wrong, and I think the central bankers themselves are wrong and largely crazy. Let me give you the most stunning example of this in recent years. In May of 2022, Jerome Powell, the head of the U.S. Federal Reserve, the same Federal Reserve that just cut interest rates by 0.5%, said, and I quote, "We are not even considering 75 basis point rate hikes." 75 basis points, meaning 0.75%. The very next month in June, they hiked by 0.75%. The month after that, they did it again. The month after that, they did it again. Then they took a month off. Then they did it again. They don't know what they're going to do. They never know what they're going to do. They only think they know what they're going to do. And some of that's not their fault. They often, I believe the hundreds of economists that work for them and for the ECB are all trained similarly in wrong things and believe in those wrong things. They all suffer from the fact that the data that they use to make decisions is not perfect data. An awful lot of the indexes and structures are not perfectly very accurate. Mm-hmm. And then finally, circumstances in real world change. And they have a hard time, they have to adapt to those changes. Part of it's not their fault at all. Part of it's just stuff changes in the middle of everything.
That might be true. And you are right, the Fed reacted too late in 2022. And now the question is if the Fed reacts too late now. Nevertheless, the stock market rallied again, and Jerome Powell emphasized that this was not a measure to protect the U.S. economy from recession, but it's not quite clear. So would you say that the stock market is right, or the economics? There's a huge gap between those. What would you say?
So capital markets, particularly stock market, think about how are profits going to be approximately 3 to 30 months into the future. Sometimes on the longer side of that, maybe even 33 or 34 months. Sometimes on the short side of that, like when COVID hit, it's something totally extreme. So it may be a month, but usually about 3 to 30 months. They're looking at valuing future profitability in that time frame somewhere, bouncing around a little shorter, a little longer over time. The reality is, as I've been saying in my Focus Money column now for a long time, it's a bull market. And it's justifiable bull market. And there's a lot of reasons for that. Saying the stock market is wrong is not an impossible thing to do correctly, but you really need to know something other people don't know that's important. The stock market is a very, very efficient pricer of all widely known facts, widely known opinions, widely known forecasts. You have to know something that other people don't know, which isn't easy to do, to say that the stock market's wrong. The stock market's actually better than pretty much most all of us, most all of the time. And therefore, my knee-jerk reaction whenever anyone asks me, is the stock market wrong, is to say, probably not. Now, mind you, let me make a different counterpoint, if I may. Stock markets around the world, particularly in developed nations, are correlated together. There's a fairly high correlation, that is, they wiggle together, mostly, between all of the developed nations, some a little more, some a little less, but the correlation between the developed nations is high. When you think of that, what that means is that if one country is having a relatively weak economic period, like is Germany, Now, but other stock markets are rising. The German stock market will be rising too, because they're highly correlated. It's really the global economy that the stock market's pricing, because the biggest, most valuable companies are global in their nature, and they've got exposure to revenue and profitability all over the world. In that, if you just look this year, you've got a German market hitting all-time highs in a time when the German economy is not strong. And so I can see how Germans see that as what you described as a huge gap. But if you actually look at global GDP, it's growing okay. If you look at U.S. GDP, it's actually growing very normally, particularly the most recent GDP revision numbers fit into the middle of historical normalcy, and at 3%. And so therefore, from that, I say to you, no, things are more or less the way they should be. This bull market will end, and exactly when we can debate, but the market isn't a wrong thing. Let me make a different point, if I may, on one more point. People say sometimes, and they're wrong, that the stock market isn't a good forecaster of the economy. And that the old line on that is that the stock market has forecasted 7 of the last 4 recessions. But the reality is, while there is some truth to that, that sometimes the stock market goes down and the economy does not, like in 2022, when the stock market's been rising, you don't ever get recession on a global basis.
Okay, just let me ask once again. So it doesn't matter that people are fear that the US economy will go into recession, or that the labor market is showing signs of a slowdown a bit and consumer sentiment in the US isn't that good as it has been before.
That's true. All of those are true.
So have a look to the election. Would you say that there is any impact whether Kamala Harris or Donald Trump will win the election? Will that have an impact for the stock markets, or would it have an impact on the economy in the US and the economy worldwide?
So let me break that down into different time periods. First, as I've written about many times, election cycles do impact stocks, and particularly that through US election cycles, because they're on a regular periodic basis, you know when they will be, unlike parliamentary increases. In that, there's things you can say. The overwhelming bulk of historical bear markets happen in the first and second year of president's terms. There hasn't been a negative third year of president's terms since 1939, as the world was going into World War II, and it was only down 0.9%. Third years of president's terms are historically just very strong, and there are reasons for that. Fourth years, the year we're in now, are not as strong as third years, but they've been positive 83% of history with above average returns, and that is what's happening this year. The fact is that elections bring, over the time that we engage in them, falling uncertainty, and markets love falling uncertainty. We always get a winner. We may not like the winner as much as we like the opponent to the winner, but we always get a winner. And with the winner comes the formation of a government. We get the formation of what Congress is or isn't, which is just about as important as the president in America. Maybe as important as the president in America, depending on exactly how the congressional elections turn out. Then there's one other feature that happens as you move into the inaugural year. So we're getting falling uncertainty as we speak. Uncertainty picked up some when President Biden stepped out of the race, which no one expected, and Kamala Harris entered, which no one expected. And that increased uncertainty initially, but now we keep moving. Both nominees pick their vice presidents. They make all kinds of statements. One of them wins. It becomes apparent in the latter part of October the likelihood of which one really wins, even in a close election. We get a winner. After we get the winner, then they start making cabinet appointments, and we start seeing a government formed, and we know how Congress is going to look, and all that's falling uncertainty, stuff like that. In the inaugural year, that history, it goes back a long way. It's not perfect, but it's very good. And that is, in the election year, when we elect a Republican, markets tend to do better than in election years when we elect a Democrat. But then that flips in the inaugural year. And in the inaugural year, markets typically do better when we elect the Democrat than when we've elected the Republican. The difference is between the Democrat and the Republican in the inaugural year, which we have coming soon, and it is that what I just said is very consistent about the Democrats. It's schizoid about the Republicans in that when the Republicans don't have a not very good year in their inaugural year, they often have a great year. Whereas with the Democrats, it's fairly consistent. The reason behind all this is that most people believe that the Republican is more pro-business, anti-regulation, more pro-free market, more anti-government, that the Democrat is more pro-big government, pro-regulation, anti-rich, anti-investor. And so the fear of the Democrat tends to be in the election year. But there's a silver lining that people don't recognize, which is that in the inaugural year, we find out that the president, whoever it is, in this case, he or she, can never do as much as some people hoped and other people feared because of that pesky Congress that exists. And most all really important things, a president is not a king or a queen. A president has to deal with that Congress, and the Congress doesn't let him do nearly as much as most people think in this election. This Congress in this election will end up in 2025 in the new Congress, both in the Senate and the House, having neither party have much of a margin. It will be very hard to get anything through that Congress. And markets like it when government can't do much.
Okay, so at a long horizon, for investors with a long horizon, it doesn't matter whether the Democrats or the Republicans will win?
Not very much. Other factors are bigger.
So let me mention one fact which I think that markets are ignoring. It's the high level of national debt in the US. Why isn't that an issue?
Because it's false.
Okay. So why is it false?
Well, in any real sense, we have less debt than we used to have. Let's be clear about it. What did we just do? We just over several years had 30% inflation, which made the value of all of the prior accumulated debt decrease in inflated dollars by 30%. We have less debt than we used to have. The government revenue and GDP are in current dollars, inflated dollars. The debt that was issued before is repaid in the dollars of the value of the time that they were issued. We haven't had a 30% increase in the amount of debt. We've had a decrease in the net amount of debt because of the inflation that occurred. Inflation is always the friend of the government until you get to the point where people won't buy government bonds. As long as people are buying government bonds at relatively similar interest rates, inflation is always the friend of the government. It's the enemy of everybody else.
So are Germans wrong with their decision not to have too much debt? Would you say that's...
The fact is the inflation just made whatever debt people had, whoever they are, and particularly the government debt, easier to repay because it's repaid in current dollars, the inflated dollars. The debt's in the dollars that it was initiated in. Is the debt going up? Yes, the debt in dollars is going up because we're going to keep issuing new debt. But in aggregate, in inflated dollars, we have less debt than we used to. So your basic premise.
So why?
It's such a simple point that people cannot seem to get in their bones. I talk to politicians all the time, both Democrats and Republicans, and none of them seem to understand that, although one of my biases is that politicians don't understand much to begin with.
So why would you say that the U.S. lost their best rating for government bonds from the agencies? What is the reason for that?
Agencies are stupid.
Okay, they...
But let me go a different direction. What matters is interest rates in the real world. Believe in prices, don't believe in rating agencies. Markets don't lie. Rating agencies can be crazy. Rating agencies can be just as stupid as the Federal Reserve. The marketplace doesn't lie. If you look at where we are in the best price to worry about is the long-term government bond in terms of understanding the issue. If there was a problem with U.S. debt, really, long-term U.S. debt interest rates would go through the roof. Yeah. The market's already told you it's not a problem.
Okay, so let's wait and see. You already mentioned Germany. Germany is in a deep structural crisis and economy is very weak. So what would you say? How can Germany reinvent itself? What has Germany to do?
Germany has a long history, in my opinion, of being careful if anything, overly prudent, and with a high degree of regulation. The best thing that it can do is free up markets and motivate startups and try to allow what Adam Smith referred to as the invisible hand of capitalism, the competitive marketplace. As I said before, create never yet done new businesses.
Mm-hmm.
Don't have what Mario Draghi talks about, which is, I mean, Mario Draghi, as you know, just unveiled his plan for Europe to try to make it more more vigorous. And it's still having the government try to pick what sectors it should invest in, what industries. This is effectively neo-mercantilism. What they should really do is motivate a startup reality world that reduces regulation and incentivizes people to start businesses.
Mm-hmm.
When people run their own businesses and start their own businesses, you get a lot of stuff happening that you can't predict. It is not predictable in any specific way, but the outcomes end up working very well. That's exactly the success of America.
So would you say that is the reason that Europe lags behind the US in this investment market?
Yes, very simply yes.
So as far as I know, Europe is good at basic research, but has a problem to translate this to products, to companies. What is the reason for that?
Before, it's mm-hmm. exactly what I just mentioned. It's exactly, the problem isn't on controlling mentality.
Mm-hmm.
It values stability over innovation. It values safety over growth. It values the established over the newly created. And the reality of how you invigorate an economy is to stimulate core growth. Think about that a different way. In terms of income per capita, the most successful European country of recent decades has been Ireland. What did Ireland do? Well, Germany could emulate what Ireland did. It would take longer and it wouldn't be as overwhelming because Germany's bigger. But the reality of motivating high-growing new companies to come to Germany by offering tax incentives for them to do so, coupled with reducing regulation otherwise, is exactly what Ireland did. I'm not suggesting trying to get Amazon to come there. That's not my point. I'm not suggesting trying to get Meta to come there. I'm not suggesting trying to get the big established. Again, I'm talking about trying to get new innovators, whether from America or other places. And, you know, innovation is not sterile in Europe. I mean, look at the largest toy company in the world. It's Danish, right next door to Germany. But if anybody had thought, when I looked at my children's, because I'm old and my children are old, if I looked at my children's Legos, it would become the largest toy company in the world. I would have thought that was crazy. And it's okay to think it's crazy because in the marketplace, what's new, different, and improves, that's what works. And that's what creates the value.
So maybe we have a look back at the current market situation. What would you say to our readers and our listeners to invest now? In August, there was a lot of volatility and a lot of fear in the market. Would you say...
Good. I like fear.
How should people react now?
Fear comes and goes in the marketplace, but fear is, again, going back to expectations versus reality, fear is an expectation that's priced in the market now. So what people should do is look at fear and say, is there anything that I actually know that's terrible that everybody else isn't already talking about? And if they're already talking about it, then you say, well, gee, my opinion is different. And then you say, is my opinion unique? And most people have opinions that are pretty much like everybody else's opinions, and opinions are priced in the marketplace perfectly. So, for example, if somebody thinks that I'm making this up, that a given politician is good or bad for the future, everybody else thinks that too. But there's nothing about a politician, a big name politician, of course, that isn't widely known, talked about, and discussed and priced in the marketplace now. And that's true whether it's, let's say, in America, Harris or Trump. And so therefore, those fears are inherently bullish. They come and go. This is sentiment. Sometimes what the worst sentiment is, you know, John Templeton, legendary Sir John Templeton, famously said, bull markets are born on pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. And you get so many people looking for euphoria that they forget that when you actually get to euphoria, nobody's looking for it. They gave up on looking for it.
So what did you buy in August when the markets went down?
Very little, because I was already fully invested.
Okay.
The reality is, think it through another way. At the beginning of September, you know that so many people said in the media, commonly said, September's the worst month in the year for the stock market. September's the worst month in the year for the stock market. So many people said that. Has it been a bad month in the stock market?
Normally it was, wasn't it?
Well, no, it started off down for a few days, but the market's up 2.5%, and the German market hit all-time highs, and the U.S. market hit all-time highs, and the MSCI World hit all-time highs, and EFIT hit all-time highs, and MSCI Europe hit all-time highs. The fact of the matter is volatility is normal in the marketplace, but the fear of September being bad and so widely dispersed as a common fear in and of itself is bullish in the market in the present.
So let's talk about the stocks. You mentioned some super stocks. So could you explain to us what are super stocks? And the question is, aren't super stocks not always super expensive?
Well, increasingly over decades, I've come to not think that way. Let me describe the way I think. The way I think is very consistent with the concepts of modern portfolio theory. But I look at expectations, and then I assess what I think future reality will be. And then I say to myself, in that environment, what do I think will do really well? And then I say something that almost no one stops to think about. I say to myself, if the things that I think will do really well don't, but instead do badly, what in that environment would do really well? And let me own some of that. Let me own some stocks that I actually hope will go down, because I hope in this environment, they'll do badly, but the stocks that I think will do well will do really well. This is what's called blending together stocks that are inversely correlated to each other. In this environment, I think these will do really well, but if instead they do really badly, what would do really well, and let me own some of that too, almost like insurance, so that therefore I don't get killed if I'm wrong. And that process makes me more stable than most people's portfolios, because most people only invest in things they think will do well. The key is to do a little better than the market. Let me say that another way. Warren Buffett famously said once upon a time that the very best investors in the market are still wrong a lot of the time. And that if you could be right 70% of the time, you'd beat almost everything. That means you better be very comfortable being wrong 30% of the time and building your portfolio so that when you are wrong, you still come out okay. If you beat the market, if you're right 60% of the time in the long term, you become one of the legendary investors eventually. The reality is most people are wrong more than they're right, because they're veering off all this short-term stuff and doing it the same way everybody else is, which is already priced. And so they end up being wrong more often than they're right. Just being passive beats most people. But if you can be right more than you're wrong by a little in the long term, that's a huge difference. And if you can be right more than you're wrong 70% of the time, you absolutely become a living legend, while still being wrong a lot. So you better be used to being wrong and know how to build your portfolio so that when you're wrong, you don't get killed.
That sounds clear to me. But in the current situation, so when people are asking for expensive technology stocks, is a good idea to stay with these stocks for a long time or to get a bit more conservative?
So let me say that this way, and that's a great question. First, I'm never wedded in the very long term to being overweight to any category. I am overweight to technology. I've been overweight to technology for a long time. I continue to be overweight to technology. But remember, mode and stuff that I think will do really, really well, while simultaneously learning from things that I think will do well if the things that I think will do well don't. Let me just say that if you take this year, you take this month, you take this week, and you say, let me just see a day where the market moves significantly up or down, as measured, let's say, by the S&P 500 or the DAX, and then compare that to how NASDAQ, reflecting technology stocks as a whole, did that day, you'll see that almost every single day, if the market's up markedly, not up a little tiny bit, not down a little tiny bit, but if it's up markedly, NASDAQ did better than the market. If it's down markedly, NASDAQ did worse than the market. Whether tech leads or lags in this period is largely a directional statement about the marketplace. If it's a bull market, tech leads. Is it the singular feature that leads? No, it's not the only thing that leads. But tech leads in this market, so being underweight do it costly. Will that come to an end? Yes, it will. When? I don't exactly know. But you will know that when you start seeing big up moves, and most of the time, tech's lagging on those days. Right now, almost every single day, when tech's up big, I mean, when the market's up a half a point or more, tech's up more. When the market's down a half a point or more, tech's down more. As long as that continues to be true, it's a statement in the short to intermediate term about what leads being purely a matter of up or down. Now, you made another point. Valuations are never predictive on any time frame that anybody cares about. And it is so hard for humans to get that. I mean, I have written so much about this for decades now. Valuations of the whole stock market, single stocks, etc., are not predictive at all over 1, 3, and 5 year periods. And people don't actually have the ability to say, boy, I think that's going to do great for 10 years, but I'm going to be really comfortable if it does lousy for the next five, if you follow that logic. The reality is people just don't have a 10-year emotional.
Would that mean that, to your opinion, the momentum play in technology is still a good idea?
A good idea. I don't really think that way, but momentum is still working for technology.
Okay.
I'm not a momentum investor, but momentum is still working for technology.
I think your aunt invested only in technology stocks. And just to make this point, would you characterize your portfolio? How big is the weighting from technology or stocks related to technology?
First, there isn't a simple answer to that, but I will try to make it as simple as I can. We're not always doing all the same thing. Sometimes we're doing things relative to the whole world market, and sometimes we're doing things relative to slices of the market. But our overweight tends to be, on tech, a 10% overweight to get in the global market. Behind that is something that most people don't think of, which is communication services, which is not tech, but it acts a lot like tech. And communication services, we're also similarly overweight to. Then behind that, the next step is similarly functioning, but not tech at all, high-end consumer luxury goods, which inherently are growth stocks. So that would be things like, in France, LVMH. Bernard Arnault is just an amazing leader of an amazing firm that no one ever would have thought would be all the thing that it is. The reality is then we are wrongly, if you will, overweight in energy, which is something that we said would do really, really well if the things that we think will do really well do badly. But we've had an overweight position in energy. And that, of course, has not helped us this year.
And your underweight positions?
Consumer staples, heavy industrials, which, of course, is big in Germany. The low end of consumer discretionary, the consumer discretionary items that are not the luxury side, and utilities, where we've been wrong.
When you say industrials, the automobile sector, is it included?
No, that's part of consumer discretionary.
You mentioned energy stocks. Are you also invested in gold, in Bitcoin?
I have at times owned gold mining shares, but that's different than owning gold. Let me just say that gold is, I know precious metals are very popular in Germanic countries, but I'm just going to say this bluntly. Gold is a thing that gets 80% of its return out of 20% of its history. It is actually got negative returns most of history. If you can time gold, you need no advice from me about anything at all, ever. The stock market is positive a little over two-thirds of history. It's a whole heck of a lot easier to be on the right side of the stock market than it is to be on the right side of the gold market. And then what I want are things that blend together with inverse correlations, as I mentioned earlier. These are the things I think will do really well. These are the things that I think will do well if those other things don't do really well. And when gold does really well, and this is something gold bugs don't like to hear, most of the time, like this year, it's positively correlated to stocks. Crypto this year is positively correlated to stocks. To get where I need to go, I don't need them. I can do that in the stock market. They don't add anything to my portfolio. I need something that counterbalances what I already know will do well in the stock market. Mm-hmm. If you take, for example, 2022, when stocks did poorly, so did gold. That doesn't help me.
I understand. Ken, one question at the end. Is it harder to gain a lot of money, or is it harder to manage a huge amount as you do? So what is easier, or what was easier for you when you started?
I don't have any problem with my liquidity. Is it easier? For me, I want to think about the question that way. I want to think about the question this way. Ease or difficulty has more to do with the person than it does with the money. It's really a question about who you are. If you're the right person, managing more money is easier than managing less money because you can almost use it like a weapon. The reality is if you're the wrong person, managing more money is worse. And even more so, if you're a different kind of wrong person, you're just going to do terribly in the marketplace. For many people, the best thing to do, which they have an almost impossible time doing, is just buying the market and sitting passively. And then they do that until there's some terrible set of headlines that come along, and then they sell out at the wrong time, which isn't actually being passive, if you follow the logic to that, because active, truly being passive is just set it and forget it. And most people can't do that. The average passive holder of investments holds them for about 18 months, which is an active usage of passiveness, which isn't passive. But my point, as I said before, is the real issue is it's more about who you are than the difficulty of the size of the money that you make.
When I'm asked whether the stock market will fall, my first reaction is probably not. The stock market is rarely wrong. I have long appreciated Ken Fisher for his ability to focus on what is really important. And as an investor, I'm honestly prefer to follow a super bull rather than a super bear. This brings us to the end of the 78th episode of Focus Money Talks. Thank you all for listening and have a great week.